Hi, thanks, Greg. So this is a talk based on a paper I have in PSCF earlier this year that was invited by the editor, Jim Peterson, and included some responses. So I thought I would present it at this meeting and get further feedback. My own view is one of the purposes of science faith dialogues is that I think we should have the ideas of science cause us to rethink our theology, our understanding of God. And likewise, I think our theological views should form, at the least, a prophetic voice to the scientific community about how science is used, if nothing else, and about how we think about it as well. So part of that context motivates this. So what I want to do is ask the question, how can physics enrich the science-theology dialogue? That was the function of the paper, and there were five main areas I concentrated on, though I don't claim these are exclusive, and I would encourage those of you with interest and expertise in the physical sciences to maybe think of more. They are, I call them, typicality, plurality, reduction, quantization, and eternity. And before I go ahead, I guess I have a confession. My name is Rob, and I too have flirted with the multiverse. Some of you may have noticed this issue of Scientific American. The August 2014 issue of Scientific American features a cover story entitled The Black Hole at the Beginning of Time. The authors, Nias F. Shorty, Robert B. Mann, that's me, by the way, and Razia Perhassan, that's one of my grad students, have come up with an idea that the universe we live in is a 3D hologram resulting from the collapse of a star into a black hole. That star and the universe it existed in had four spatial dimensions. This hypothesis, the authors assert, can answer the riddle about where the universe came from and what caused the Big Bang. Well, you might imagine that could get reaction on the blogosphere, as it did last fall when we put the paper on the archive and Nature News picked it up, and then it went, as they call it, viral in the blogosphere. We got a lot of email last fall about it and a lot of things in the blogosphere, mostly critical of this idea. One accusing us of having a crypto-Catholic-Islamic-fascist alliance or some crazy thing. I'm not making this up. But since this article came out, we've had other reaction, and I'm showing it to you because I thought this is an example of physics influencing faith, whether you like it or not. So this is from this website that you see down at your lower right on the screen. As extravagant as this idea may appear to be, the authors offer ways in which it can be tested. They say we can study the cosmic microwave background radiation looking for thermal fluctuations as evidence for the extra four-dimensional bulk matter. Also, if the large-scale structure of the universe appeared different in different directions, it might be evidence of a spinning four-dimensional black hole that birthed the cosmos. In any case, this work may be a milestone, oh gosh, in our long quest to finally understand why our universe exists. Notice the theological tinge. This person is not a Christian, to the best of my knowledge. I'm hoping science succeeds in answering the question that religion and philosophy failed to answer satisfactorily. Where did the world come from? So that's the non-theist side. Here's one from the theist side. The Word of God speaks of four dimensions, the breadth, length, depth, and height. The following paragraphs are from Scientific American. Perhaps the boundaries between dimensions are less stable than we thought. Modern cosmology holds the Big Bang was immediately followed by inflation, a period of rapid expansion of space in which the early universe increased its volume by a factor of 10 to the 78 or more. Yet this expansion provides no insight into what caused the Big Bang. Our four-dimensional universe, in contrast, gives us an answer to the ultimate mystery, where did the universe come from? Of course, even as the holographic Big Bang resolves one giant question, the origin of our universe, it simultaneously raises a new set of mysteries. This is part of my contribution, in case you hadn't. I tried to stick this into the article. Foremost among them, where did our universe's parent universe come from? And then that's the quote. Then the rest of the blog says, there's a lot more, but the blog says when they finally arrive at the answer, they will discover that the children of faith are already there. So you see these extremes, and I just presented that to you in the sense that I think all of science is applied science, because if it doesn't influence our technology, our medicine, or our social situation, the ideas of science, the outcomes of science, affect our thinking, our ideas, and our theology, be it theistic or not. So let's go through these five things. Typicality. Is the Copernican principle in conflict with theology? I don't think anybody in this room would deny the utility for astronomy and modern science of asking what would happen if the sun were at the center and the planets orbit the sun. This would get rid of all these nasty retrograde motions in the Ptolemaic system, and in fact, it got rid of epicycles at all. Now, we would not claim our position in space is specially distinguished in any way. That's a quote from Hawking and Ellis's book that says that we should apply this principle wherever possible. And so it's become de rigueur in science and physics to think we've got to apply this everywhere. Now, it's very useful, but there's a place where it doesn't work, and that's temporally. The universe is not Copernican at all times. We have a Big Bang, we have a developmental history, we have knowledge, partial, very partial, about how galaxies form, and we have good predictions about what's going to happen next. We appear to be Copernican spatially, but not temporally. In fact, the steady-state universe was developed to try and imply a Copernican principle temporally, and the data didn't agree with it. So there is a dynamic tension, I claim, between typicality and uniqueness in Christian theology that perhaps is partially reflected in science. It rains upon the just and the unjust, Jesus tells us. That's typicality. And yet the hairs of our head are numbered, so Jesus tells us, by a loving God. So I think one of the challenges physics presents us with, it's a challenge in science and for theology, what do we make of typicality? What is an appropriate application of it, and what is not? We're often accused in Christian faith, oh, you Christians, you think we're special. If you find you're not special, that's bad news for you. Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. And I think we need to think about where typicality is appropriately applied. Here's a statistical distribution on the upper right. This problem is as follows. Do we incorporate science interpreted via typicality, or do we challenge the secular demotion of humanity? Typicality is often used to say, oh, we've been demoted. We thought we were special, science found we weren't here. We thought we were special, science found we weren't there. Demote, 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 demote. So goes the standard mythology. But people like Dennis Danielson have countered this, saying the Copernican revolution was a promotion, because Earth was one step away from the guck of hell at the core. And by realizing we weren't at the center, it actually was better. It was not until 100 years later that people thought, began to think this is kind of a demotion. Didn't come from Copernicus at all, and you can talk to Dennis about the details there. But it raises this question. What about human significance? Can it be given a scientific basis or not? Is science necessarily in conflict with our understanding? Is typicality falsifiable? One of the reasons why I think physicists like it is because it gives you a program of calculation. If you believe something is typical, then we can apply the arsenal of our statistical knowledge to the system to see how it's typical. But what if it's not typical? Then what do we do? And that raises the question if atypicality, particularly applied to our universe, is testable and what the implications are for faith. So here's a corner of the multiverse that has some characters. How do we know if thing one and thing two are typical? Is their height typical? Is their identity typical? What about the Lorax or Yertle the Turtle or Sam I Am or the Cat in the Hat? I mean, I'm being obviously facetious and hyperbolic to emphasize the point that in the context of demonstrating the typicality of large-scale reality in our universe, there's a high degree of ignorance, and I am very skeptical that we can apply statistical distributions to this because we don't know where to put the norm. except with what Don Page would call prior probabilities. But those prior probabilities, I still don't have a good answer to how they can be scientific. But this is a question, to what extent we can falsify typicality, and I would say, how do we understand human significance in an apparently indifferent universe? This is another dictum that comes out of typicality. The universe doesn't care one whit whether any of us are here or not. At least as I read the secular literature, that would be my understanding of it. Yet we claim otherwise as Christians. Part of the good news of the gospel is there is a loving God who actually does give a whole lot more than one whit as to whether we are here or not. So these are the kinds of questions I want to encourage people in science and faith to think about. Now, what about plurality? Well, there's that good old multiverse. And the idea of this is that our observable universe, symbolized by that little purple bubble there, is a tiny part of a much larger structure that is replicated in various variants in various ways, the hope being that some of the features of our universe that are special, apparently atypical, would become typical. But I want to move away from that and ask, if we have this kind of picture, we have what is called plurality. Is our universe one of many, a multiverse? And what happened in the panel discussion, what I tried to advocate, I think we have a real need for a scientific cost-benefit analysis of this. Is this really a good hypothesis? Now, the benefits, well, string theory was supposed to give us, when I was a boy, the unique ultimate theory. But then it sort of changed in which it gave us every possible universe. So then they turned around and say, oh, this is a great thing. It's giving us this landscape where every universe can possibly exist. Well, if you believe in string theory circa its version 10 years ago instead of 30, you'll have that. What disturbs me a bit more, I would say, is cosmic inflation to the extent the data verifies it or not. The recent BICEP results are being called into question. Sits comfortably in a multiverse. It doesn't have to sit in a multiverse, but it does sit comfortably there. And so I think it is a bit of a challenge for us to ask, okay, is this really the right way to go? The costs of it, I think, are obvious. It decouples science from observation. By definition, we can't observe outside of the observable. It isn't possible. This is a radical change from science, I might say based on the previous talk, going back to the Aristotelian way. Why bother to look into the heavens? You can deduce it in an Aristotelian fashion. And that is where we will be led to if we go down this trail. Now, so I think there's also a need for a theological cost-benefit analysis. And here, I'm trying to be open-minded. I know it's not easy, but I try. Benefits. God is the maximally sovereign creator, the ultimate generous creator who creates universe after universe because he is so giving, so loving, so abundant. However, the costs are, I think, theodicy runs wild. Unless we're the one bad apple in the multiverse where bad stuff happens and good stuff happens everywhere else, or maybe. But that's not going to happen if you believe these are generated in any scientific manner. So the other issue is that if all possibilities are duplicated, then this ASA, CSCA, CIS meeting has happened 10 to the 1 zillion times with all possible variations. Do we really believe that? When you ask people that promote it, you know what they do? They giggle. Maybe because it's kind of a silly way to go. Right? I mean, okay, I can't say it's wrong, but really think about the implications of going down this trail, please. I don't know how you get purpose and meaning. And scientifically, we have this problem. What is the boundary between the actual and the possible? What actually does exist versus what possibly exists? It's the job of theoretical science to delineate the possible, given the laws of nature. It's the job of empirical and applied science to ask what is actual out of the possibilities, which ones actually do we see? And we have this interplay. In the multiverse, we lose the ability to draw this boundary based on observation. And I've discussed that elsewhere more in the article. Theologically, the good news is it keeps theologians employed because we now have to grapple with creatio ex omnia. Why is there something rather than everything? The old question is, why is there something rather than nothing? Right? We know there's something. We don't know if there's everything. But if we believe there isn't everything, why is there something instead of everything? Or if you believe there is everything, well, then what kind of God do you believe in? Everything means everything. It means I painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel in some part of the multiverse. I'm not kidding. Plurality, now this one I'll go through quickly because David did a great job in the previous talk of asking the questions that we have a mini multiverse problem in our own universe. Planets are common. So far, none are quite Earth-like, but some come mighty close. So are we the sole inhabitants of our galaxy? Is life common or rare? Is sentient life common or rare? Those are very good questions to ask. And theologically, here's one for the secular community. Why do we care? There's not a single immediate application I can think of, except what was alluded to that Hoyle said. Deep down, we're all religious, and we want to know if we're alone or not. I can't think of any other reason why human beings want to know the answer to this question. So that's a good question, perhaps as a form of witness. But where I think the secular world thinks it threatens the Christian community is that it would be the nail in the coffin to point to blind evolutionary process as the origin of life. See that? Weird aliens grow up on other worlds. It's evolution. You guys pack up your Bibles, burn them up, except put one in a museum because we're not that ignorant. And then, you know, that's what we'll do. Well, I think we do have to address and answer that kind of question. What is the imago Dei? We believe we are created in the image of God. How will that apply to other sentient intelligence? I don't think this is a trivial question to answer, but that's good because it keeps theologians employed, just the way the physics keeps me employed. And also at a practical level, if we do encounter aliens, C.S. Lewis addressed this, how will we treat the other? This is a question of applied Christianity. How God loves us all, yet we do all have difficulty encountering the other, the alien, the person who irritates us, the culture that is not like ours. How will we do such a thing? All right, let's go ahead. Reductionism. Here are the four forces of nature symbolized: gravity, electromagnetism, weak, the radioactive symbol up there, and the strong force with the nucleus. We now have a complete theory of all particles and forces that we can observe. That's the triumph of the Standard Model when the Higgs boson was discovered. We now have a working description of every known force and particle in nature. This is indeed a historical milestone. It's like the subatomic version of the periodic table has been completed. So is this a triumph? Well, sure, in one sense. All known structures in nature can be reduced to quarks, leptons, and forces that we would call gauge bosons. Good, that's great. But not yet, because it also appears we've discovered in the last few decades that the known energy content of the universe is only 5% of this stuff in the Standard Model. Another 23-25% is dark matter. It's gravitating stuff, but apart from that, it's made of Star Trek particles, as Barth Netterfield said. It's made of junk that's gravitationally attractive, but apart from that, it is not known, made of any known matter on the Earth. Even worse is dark energy, which is gravitationally repulsive and is causing the universe to accelerate. We don't know what that is either. So, in some sense, we have no clue what lies beyond the Standard Model, how to describe these other particles. Again, that's good because it means my students can get jobs. And so can you if you want to go on the physical side. It's a great adventure, but we should not let the triumph of reductionism march through the streets quite yet. Theologically, have we closed the last gap for God? Or, as I like to think, have we discovered a deeper intelligibility pointing to a subtle creator? I think intelligibility points to an intelligence. In my view, this is a positive argument for the existence of God as opposed to a negative one. It's not this, it's not that, therefore God. I think it is one we should be bolder in expressing to the secular community. It's not a rock-solid 2 plus 2 equals 4 proof, but it is a, I think intelligibility points to an intelligence and it's rational to follow that hypothesis. That's very hard to argue against. The usual one is, well, I don't need that hypothesis. Well, then you get other problems, and they should be pointed out. How do we go beyond intelligibility to a God of love, and what are the limits of reduction? Is the cosmos indeed optimal in the way Don Page liked to articulate in his talk? We can think about that. Quantization. Here is an example of where science and theology are helping each other. I really like this example. John Polkinghorne has come up with it. Nature, we know, is not fully atomized. It has a wave-particle duality. You look at electrons one way, they behave like particles. You change the experiment, they behave like waves. The same happens for light. That's what that picture on your upper left symbolizes. You send photons through a birefringent crystal, they undergo parametric down conversion, and in the overlap regions between those circles, the photons are in what we call an entangled superposition, where they are neither one thing nor the other, and where the whole is indeed greater than the sum of the parts in terms of its polarization. Well, this whole parts distinction is blurred, and this modifies the everyday laws of probability, and this is well established by zillions of experiments. So scientifically, this has raised questions as to the ontology and epistemology of the wave function. Does the wave function tell us what actually exists, or is it simply a statement of our knowledge, and we can't go better than that? This, I think, has implications for theology. To what extent do we say what we know from the Bible is about what actually exists, or is this just our partial knowledge? There is potential, as people know probably here, for coding and computing, but theologically you enter something called perichoretic entanglement. In other words, perichoresis is an old idea coming out of the Greek Orthodox Church, as I understand it, for understanding the Trinity. God is one, yet God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What, you guys are polytheists? No, God is one, but God is three. Entanglement helps us understand this because we now have another example in nature where two kinds of light, well, you look at this, it's one thing, but it's not one thing. They are entangled. Likewise, the traditional long historic Christian understanding of perichoresis, of the Trinity, is allowing scientists to better articulate and find metaphors for how to express entanglement. There is a book on this by John Polkinghorne. So that is one theological application. At a practical level, the potential for exploitation in coding and computing should cause us all to ask the question, what are appropriate uses of new information technology? Anybody ever heard of Edward Snowden? Checked what the NSA is doing lately? Or CSIS, if you're in Canada. I think we need to ask questions about how to use this technology. It's growing faster than any one person knows how to deal with. Eternity. We've had a long time in going from measuring time via Stonehenge to these cesium clocks that can get accuracies of 10 to the minus 15 seconds. Yet, what this shows us is throughout history, humans have been fascinated by measuring time. But what is it? Is time epistemic or ontological? Is saying that we have yesterday, today, and tomorrow simply no more than alphabetization? In other words, the relationship of time to reality is simply nothing more than the relation of the alphabet to ordering names in a phone book. That was Leibniz's view. Or is it an actual existing thing that clocks measure? Time flows on like a river, the way Newton thought. Well, we don't really know. We know that from general relativity, time is squishable, fungible. We can use different coordinates to re-express time as part of space and space as part of time. And yet, we also know from quantum theory that time has a direction. We can't go backwards in time. I can't do it. You all know how silly that is. I can't go backwards in time. much as it would be fun to so do. Time actually has seven different arrows altogether, a thermodynamic arrow, a cosmological arrow, a subatomic arrow, things that say time goes one way and not another. So, what about that? Well, we don't know what to make of that. We also have no idea whatsoever, well, I shouldn't say we have no ideas that work, as to how to put gravity together with quantum mechanics. They have very distinct concepts of time. So, is time atomized? Is time fungible? Where do the arrows come from? All of these are good scientific questions, but we are very far from putting these gravity together with the quantum because of these distinct concepts in the two views. Theologically, I'm inclined to think a temporal arrow means purpose exists in the universe. The universe is going somewhere. However, scientifically, it's going in a bad direction. Sooner or later, the sun's going to run out of fuel. The universe will expand to diluteness. Everything will get swallowed in a black hole, and that's it. So there is some need for eschatological salvation that science is pointing to. We literally need God to rescue us. There is no technology that can solve this problem, ever. And, of course, we have much further doom scenarios, like will we overheat the planet, will we run out of fuel, and so on. So what this is my last slide. Here are a few other things we can think about in terms of how we get physics to interact with the Christian faith. I hope that maybe the article in this talk will get some of us to think about how we move beyond what may be a traditional defense of apologetic to perhaps a more proactive one in which we look at the results of modern physics and ask how does it influence our theology, and we look at our new theological understandings, respecting the integrity of the scriptures, don't get me wrong, I don't want to not do that, but in a way that respects the integrity of the scriptures but can speak to a secular world that I think finds it much more difficult to listen to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Thanks for your attention. Well, yeah, that's one argument, is could God have multiple purposes? Of course the answer is yes, but the trouble with a multiverse is you've got to constrain it, and then the challenge is what's an appropriate constraint. So in some sense, a difficult question is, do we live in a polyverse? Maybe there's 10 different universes. That's not so bad. Well, what about 1,000? Okay, what about 10 billion? What is n, right? One is simpler. It's one of the simplest, 0, 1, infinity, which is it? But you're right, God could have multiple purposes. That can't be ruled out.
What do you think about the multiple interpretations of quantum mechanics as being a nice principle for humility and for connecting different religions and such things?
That's a very interesting idea. I hadn't heard it quite expressed like that before. I think it's an interesting idea. The instinct in a scientist, at least like me, is whenever you have five different ideas, the idea is to whack them all till one survives. So the hope is this dialogue will eventually converge on something that we think is a better and better approximation to the truth. I'm an idealist scientifically and also theologically. I think the function of theological dialogue in part should be toward a convergence of the truth. It's going to happen a lot slower than science, but as opposed to just let's just draw the boundary lines around each camp. But it's a very good point. It's a very good point. Well, there are some that are different, so ultimately these different interpretations should come up with different experimental predictions, one would hope. At the moment, a lot of them don't, you're quite right, but the hope is someday they will. There was one over here.
Okay, sorry.
Christina, you.
If there's anything like God, it would have to have evolved.
I'm just wondering, is it sort of too much of a concession to say, well, maybe God did evolve in the previous universe and then created us, or else, and also for me that kind of helps in the sense of kind of the court of heaven, which is mentioned in Psalms, as maybe a reason why God had to do the crucifixion and the atonement, because otherwise it doesn't seem to make sense that God has to stick to this kind of, you know, sacrifice thing when he's God and can just, you know, forgive. But if there are other gods out there with their own universes, and God's in charge of our universe, then he's got to do it in front of an audience, and therefore he's got to get the justice this bit right. And that would maybe explain a bit better why Jesus had to die.
Well, that's a rather complicated question. I think, you know, I don't see any reason why a God necessarily, quote, had to evolve any more than the laws of physics, quote, had to evolve. There is some research going on as to whether the laws of physics might have evolved, but if they did, we have absolutely no evidence they evolved within this universe since the Big Bang. That's one of the constancies we put in. The laws of physics are the same now as they were 13.7. So the way I would look at Christian theology is we sort of have jumped to the end. If there is a God that is evolving, one would just look at the sort of super God that is the whole picture put together, I would say. So it's in some sense our belief in God is a bit like believing there is an ultimate theory of nature. And in my view, the two are not decoupled from one another. So I don't see the epistemic value of what he says. I mean, the only thing I've seen Richard Dawkins say, well, not that I've read a lot of what he says, I've read some books, that's positive would be that when he had this debate with Francis Collins, he said there's a deeper mystery here that we got to understand. And Collins would say, that's God. And then Dawkins said, yes, but it's not the parochial God of the standard religions. Well, there's a little bit where I would agree. I think we need to go beyond parochialism with integrity, but he wants to throw the baby out with the bathwater, from what I can see. And it's a bit like, you know, Aristotelian physics generated, in part, the physics we have now. I mean, so anyway, I could go on. It's a long question, but I better stop. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Robert.
So Qingbin.